Welcome back to the podcast. Rick Collins, welcome. The owner of Explore Alaska Charters here in Ketchikan, recently retired teacher. Thanks for being on the podcast, man.
Yeah, you bet.
So I guess maybe start there. When you were a senior in high school, would you have thought that one day you'd be a retired teacher from Ketchikan High School and own a charter business in Ketchikan?
No, definitely not.
What was your path when you were leaving as a senior?
Yeah, that's kind of a tough one. I mean, I knew I wanted to come home to Ketchikan. I did know that. It's a pretty unique place, and family and friends, and you know, all the hunting and fishing and boating. So I knew I wanted to come home, but I wasn't quite sure. I had applied to, my father's a Marine pilot, and so he pilots foreign hulled vessels around in the Inside Passage, and I was kind of thinking about following in the family footsteps there. I applied to Cal Maritime, got accepted, and then I had one of my best friends was a floatplane, he flies for Alaska Airlines now, but he wanted to fly floats, and I worked that summer for a place called West Flight, and so I was contemplating, you know, I was a ramp rat tying up airplanes and stuff, and I'd contemplated maybe going off to fly with my buddy, and so I applied to a couple of flying places also, and the real thing was I had a really strong teacher in biology, Mrs. Prather. I loved her. She was an amazing teacher, and I just loved biology, so I just kind of thought I would, and I really liked people and things like that, so I thought, you know, I would just go into college. I ended up going to Western Washington University and just kind of knew that I wanted to follow science for the time being. And I just wasn't sure if I would love the lifestyle of being a Marine pilot or an air pilot. But they both seem like really cool jobs still to me. You know, so.
When you graduated, obviously tourism hadn't exploded like it has, because that was kind of a late 90s, early 2000s thing. So as far as job prospects coming back or jobs you had in high school, what was that like? A lot of kids now, I mean, you have kids who can be a kayak guy during the summer, just make a lot of money or cutting fish. So what was it like when you were in high school?
Yeah, it was just, I would say that front edge of the real big, I mean, I think if you look at graphs, you can see the big booms that, you know, the cruise industry had, and that really had a lot to do with them building bigger and bigger ships. So we were going through a phase of bigger ships when I was in high school. I remember playing baseball and stuff in town and watching the tour buses go by. And then in the fall at football practice, watching them as well. And that was, it seemed like one of the only things they were doing is some flight seeing, but not a lot of flight seeing. And then cruise ship buses and whatnot. But there was getting to be a lot of ships around. So there was a few jobs downtown, but most of my friends worked at a place called Silver Lining Seafoods or E.C. Phillips. They were working in the canneries and they were making a lot of money. My dad, and he had done some seining when he was a kid, and my grandma and my dad's stepdad owned a gill netter, and I'd done a little bit of gill netting with them, and I would, like, my freshman, sophomore year of high school, they'd come back from Tree Point after 4 days or so, and I would hand pitch their fish at Phillips, and they'd give me a, you know, I think I made about $50. It was like, I don't know. I think it was like, I want to say it was like 0.5% or 1%, something like that. It was my first taste of, you know, and then pretty soon he just started paying me $50. But it was a good thing. I mean, when I was, you know, ninth grade or something like that, it was pretty hard work, you know, and it was short though. It was just a few hours, but it whetted my appetite. So I ended up getting into commercial fishing. I fished with the Haynes family, Danny Haynes, and you know, and I did some long lining with Dan Castle and also with Ole Haynes and a little bit with Harold Haynes. And yeah, that was great experience, incredible experience, and helped me pay for college. So,
and that was mostly around here, right? You didn't have to make super long runs, because I know you're both Max and Andy, your kids, went to Bristol Bay the last couple of years, right?
So no, Max seined around here with Russell Cockrum, who's kind of a legend in the area also. I mean, he's just awesome. And then Andy ended up in Area M, which is up by Falls Pass and you know, those areas. So he was, you know, that fishery's kind of, there's a number of guys that have kind of migrated up there and started working there. So that put Andy a long ways away, but he was also working for a Ketchikan guy, Dan Castle. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed my, I fished a long line trip with Dan and was around him for different things and really enjoyed working with him. And so that was a good opportunity for Andy also, and worked out great. So
what were those summers like? I never did the commercial fishing. I worked at the fish hatchery in Kluwak growing up for most of the summers, but we'd take a family vacation down to Colorado, see the relatives and whatnot. So never did the commercial thing, but, what was that summer job like? Was it nice?
Yeah. I mean, I think if I look back, I mean, there's a few, I think my dad would have pretty high standards for a lot of things for me, like, just different chores or whether it's bottom painting the boat or, he would kind of call my BS if I was younger and was trying to take shortcuts, right? And so it sort of prepped me for it. And then I think, I used to go to this intensive wrestling camp when I was a kid, and it was 4 to 5 workouts a day from like, sometimes it'd surprise you and wake you up at 5 in the morning and then you'd lights out at 11 p.m., right? And so that was super hard in my life, like incredibly physical and mentally difficult. But saying that's kind of it's an easier fishery compared to some, but it also always depends on who you work for and how hard they go after it. And it's real men's work. It's one way to put it, even though ladies do it as well nowadays. I didn't mean it, I guess, that way. But, it's just hard work. And so it was an incredible experience for me. So I think I think my work ethic was there and my pride in my work was there already. But it kind of kicked me to another level. And long lining was another thing I did as well. And that was shorter and more intense than seining, but definitely shorter. Seining's kind of a longer thing. But, it wasn't all hard work. There's times when you're cruising out in the sunshine just looking for fish jumping. And, you got a ton of camaraderie with your buddies. And to this day, I still stay close with the crew that I worked with. And you learn a lot of different skill sets. You learn network. You learn mechanical things. You learn how to paint. We used to, operate these wooden boats and, how to splice lines and lash things and whippings with twine. And there's just a lot of things. When I was fortunate enough to stand most of the night wheel watches and stuff on the boat. And so I learned a lot of skills that way. And I think we were talking the other day about another related thing that, back then when I was doing wheel watches, we didn't have GPS, it was a compass. We had an autopilot, when it wasn't being temperamental. And then, radar, and that's it. There's no, we had a Loran receiver, but it was not that accurate and we pretty much never used it. So, so I was able to learn and just develop a ton of skills. I can't, recommend it enough for people for shape and work ethic and for learning a lot of different skills. And I think you just learn how to work hard and work fast, because if you get the job done, you can actually go get some extra sleep. And sleep becomes a really big deal, because you might be up for 17, 18, sometimes more hours, maybe 20 hours. And then you might do that for a couple days. And then you get to take these power naps that I could never do now, but you can sleep, when you're that age, you can sleep 12, 15 hours, no problem. Yeah. So anyway, great experience, great memories. And, it was an awesome opportunity. And again, it paid for college. And, when I got done with college, I paid for my wife's wedding ring and kind of helped me get started. It was a good deal. So
was there ever a temptation? Sometimes you get the kids who make a lot of money during the summer and they think, well, why go to college? I can just stay here and keep making a whole bunch of money. Were you ever tempted to just stick around and just fish, fish, fish?
No. I mean, I did think about potentially running a seine boat. I have a ton of respect for those guys. It is, you have to be good at, mechanical things, hydraulics, business side of things, vessel maintenance, your net. You have to be a pretty good leader. You have to then also know how to catch fish and have to be able to understand the weather and the fish runs. And there's just so much going on there. I have a ton of respect for that. And I had thought about it a little bit, and that's kind of a hard jump when you're that age. And I remember being confident enough to feel like I could do this. But then the same time, I always felt like I was missing out. Like there was a lot of social things going on in mm-hmm. town for people my age. And you're gone a lot. You know, you're working pretty much every day. I mean, I remember some of the days off we had where we actually had the day to go water skiing or up to Harriet Hunt and jet ski or things like that. And mm-hmm. that was pretty awesome. And I guess I just, that was one hang up I had. And also with the maritime industry, like my father, is that you're just going to be out overnight for, you know, a lot of times. And, you know, I remember not having my dad around for different times because he would go to the shipyard for a month or something in Seattle or 2 months. And I remember missing him and whatnot. So that was always kind of my hang up with maritime and with seining. I still look back on some of these careers and go, yeah, I could have seen myself doing that. And I think they're really cool and would be really exciting and fun. I mean, bringing a cruise ship to the dock would be amazing. But my biggest hang up at that stage of my life was I wanted to be home nightly and, mm-hmm. You know, and be around more. And I would assume a lot of those guys kind of battle that a little bit, you know. But it's a cool job. And yeah. they get work really hard in the summer and have a lot of time off in the winter months. So I think every job, even our teaching job mm-hmm. that we had, there's pros and cons and, you know, give and take and whatnot. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the assumption is that you just automatically make a ton of money fishing during the summer. And that's not always the case. I remember early on in my teaching career, I was back on Prince of Wales, as I did as soon as the school was out in California. I was up on Prince of Wales to just play.
Yeah.
Which I loved, you know, because then right. you get the summers off to really enjoy it.
Right.
And a buddy of mine, or high school basketball teammates, he leased a boat to fish. And it was, you know, 1924 wooden boat, you know, just a real old thing. And his crew was a buddy of mine who'd been on a lot of commercial fishing boats and another one who just wanted to pay off some of his pilot school. And it just seemed like everything just went wrong.
Oh, right.
It was just a constant, just, it was horrible.
Yeah.
They weren't finding fish. They weren't getting fish. Stuff was breaking down. And so, you know, they had these dreams of, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, you know, big hauls, and it just didn't happen. And just, it underscored, I'd never seen it that close a range, just the other side of it. You know, people make a lot of money and they put a lot of it back into the boats, have these beautiful boats with all the great gear to make the fishing experience much more efficient. And then during the winter going down somewhere else to either to fish or just vacation. And I saw those three guys just get hammered.
Yeah.
And it was really tough to kind of see and just underscored that it's a bit of a crapshoot and how difficult it is to become one of those experienced captains who has all the intuition and has everything. It's not something that someone can just pick up, do, and make a ton of money.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a couple things. You know, there's a saying a lot of times that 90% of the or 10% of the people make 90% of the money in some of these fisheries. And that's true. And that, you know, can be based on the equipment they have or just their, some of these guys just have that it factor for catching fish, right? And then others just simply work harder, much harder, and that gets them where they need to go. You know, so I think there's some of that. But like any business, if you just start, there's up cycles and down cycles in the you know, economics of the fishery. And then there's so much front loading in any business, you know, that you have to develop your equipment, and you have a lot of upfront costs. And basically, I think that's pretty tough. I mean, Andy, in fact, is, you know, he's brainstorming, my youngest, he'll brainstorm different ideas. And he's like, what do you think if I, you know, bought a crab or bought, you know, did some Dungeness crabbing or things like that. And he's thinking of it as, you know, exciting ways to, you know, he's kind of chomping at the bit to do his own thing, right? And he's still wanting to pay for college with it. And I'm just like, you know, you are better off staying with, you know, Dan or any of these guys that are just, they are established and they are highliners and they are experts at what they do. And you're going to, you know, you're just going to make that money instead of have to deal with the overhead when all of a sudden you lose gear or you have a mechanical and you have to rebuild the engine. And that's just not really a position you probably want to be in when you're going to college. You know, when you're done with college, if he wants to continue to do something like that, I think that's probably better. But, you know, I just kind of, we talk about pros and cons and then it's their life. They mm-hmm. get to live it, right? You had kind of asked when I decided you know, maybe or maybe not on the fishing. I remember one day, you know, the sunny days when you're loading up the boat and doing really well. I remember like the summer of 89 was just spectacular. And I ended up, you know, doing the cliche thing and bought a brand new four-wheel drive rig so I could go skiing. And I was still paying for college and everything was good. And then, you know, the next year was quite a bit slower. I just remember we were on a four-day opening. And maybe it wasn't a 4-day. I just remember being a multiple day opening and being real tired. The cook made humpy stew, and it was just flayed out pink salmon and with the skin still on it, with some onions and some water and really nothing else. I mean, it was so bland and I'm sitting there picking at it, and there was still some sea lice on the skin, and it was pouring down rain, and I'm just like, yeah, I better keep working hard in college. You know, I just remember feeling that like it's something I needed to do. Mm. So, but you know, it's not for everybody. And
yeah.
And a lot of these guys that take off and start fishing hard at a young age and build themselves up, I mean, they're killing it. I mean, you know, and the really good ones can insulate themselves from the down cycles and, you know, by being, you know, budgeting and being smart with their money. Mm. So anyway.
So did you start teaching and then add on the other business, and how did you get into the charter business?
Yeah. So I was always kind of gravitated to the water, you know, maritime stuff. I'd still, you know, I was still like year two or three kind of starting to think about Cal Maritime again. And so it was just always there. And I fished commercially, you know, like another year after I graduated from college. And then, you know, my wife and I got married, and in the summer, the first summer, I was like, my whole mindset was, you know, teachers, you get the summer off, et cetera. I was really excited about that. And so that first summer was the only summer I took off. I went up and did 4 weeks up at UAF for some science teacher training. And then I camped and goofed off and had a blast but it was, things were pretty tight, and we were trying to save for a house. So the next year I ran a boat, harbor tour boat for Dale Pillman in the harbor, and then like out to Totem Bight and stuff. It was one of the tours that were going on. So I was still around the water. And then trying to think, I had two summers where I did not work on land. We did get enough money to get a house, and then as a result, we had to do a lot of house projects. So I was lucky. I worked for a guy named Ron Klinger, who was one of my best friend's dads. Ron was, you know, like in a lot of ways, like a, you know, an uncle or something to me. And so I worked for him one summer, and then Larry Setchi for another summer. And they were both giving me tons of info and letting me borrow tools for remodeling the place. And then the next year I went back to work for, Goldbelt, running those high speed catamarans, aluminum ones. Alan Marine does them now. This was an Alan Marine built boat, but it was for Dale Pillman's company. And so I was running back to the Misties every day in the summer. And then, let's see, I got approached by, Jeff Gross at Southeast Exposure, the kayak company. I was coaching and trying to go to summer wrestling camps and things like that, and he offered me a job running these inflatable, blue inflatable boats. I'm pretty sure they still have them out there for the kayakers out to Tatoosh. And at the time, we were stationed in Knutson Cove, and I was kind of looking at all the charter guys, and I knew some charter guys, and I had bought a boat. I was pretty excited to have my own boat instead of just the family. You know, my dad always let me use boats from the time I was like 11 or something all the way through. I always had a boat to use, which was great experience. And so I bought this boat, and then it had,
what was it?
It was a Bayliner 28 by 10 trophy, which was a great hull and great design. Really loved it. It was a perfect family boat, but had fishing cockpit space, and I was pretty stoked, but it had an IO, and we had a mechanic look at it, and he kind of missed the fact that it was like burning a quart of oil an hour or something like that. So anyway, and I bought it out of Washington. So anyway, it ended up having issues. And so I had to borrow money to put a new engine in it. And then we got the engine bolted in and everything. And within 20 hours, the outdrive went out. So then I had to borrow some more money. So I was kind of completely upside down on this boat. And one of my best friends, Sean Mitchell, was kind of saying, you know, you should guide, and you know, you'd be good at it. You should do it. And I didn't want to because some of my buddies in college, we all had season passes at Mount Baker, and we'd ski. And a couple of our friends took the bait one year and decided it'd be really cool to work there. Mm. And every time we'd get on the chair, Gerald and these guys would look at us and just shake their head. They were so jealous because they were working and we were skiing, and I didn't want to make my plaything a work thing. Mm. But I was upside down on the boat, so that's how I got sucked in. So, and I think that was in 2004. And the shocker was I ended up loving it. I didn't think I would like it. And so my initial plan was just do it a couple years to try to pay for the engine that I'd put in, and I ended up really liking it, and it kind of mushroomed from there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, a couple of people have asked me about why don't I guide, mostly like river guide, and they said, well, you're a teacher, and you're just teaching people how to fish. And I thought, well, fishing is what I love to do. I'm not sure if I would love to teach people how to fish, and then it would take away from my own fishing experience. So I never really dove into that, but some people who love it, I guess it's kind of like commercial fishing too. If you're into it, you can do it. But if you're not, it's just not, you really got to have a love and passion for it, because otherwise it's just not going to work out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's tough. I also did fly fishing, fly out guiding. And I really liked that as well. I did that for probably 8 years. Or 10 years. I don't know. I lose track. But I did it for a fair bit, and I did like it. And I would say that the teaching part helps because you have patience. As you know, if you're a good teacher, I mean, that's just part of the gig, right? So all of that worked out, and it gave me an opportunity to go explore a lot of places. I loved flying and getting out there, you know. I mean, obviously I didn't do the flying, but sitting there and watching and learning that side of things as well. And then just, you know, getting a day off the ocean, which was really cool. You just kind of know things. Like, people have asked if I was ever interested in teaching elementary, and I'm like, no, definitely not my thing. I mean, I love young kids. I did some coaching at that age group, a fair bit of coaching at that age group. I liked it, but teaching, I know the answer to that would be no. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway,
as far as tech goes, like when you started out, chartering, you know, how much better are things now, or is it marginal improvement based, or over the stuff that you had when you're in high school? Cause I know with like fly fishing, they come out with stuff, but once they went to graphite, it's just all pretty much amazing gear. If you look at some of the old timers, people were fishing with the fiberglass stuff.
Yeah.
You know, those old reels, man, it's just the stuff we have now fishing gear wise is just, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm really fascinated by those bamboo rods. They're just really pretty, you know. But yeah, it's something else. Technology is amazing. I mean, one of the things I think about is just the quality of garments. I think it's the biggest thing in a lot of ways. You know, when I would go fishing with my dad, I was always really more into freshwater fishing, as a thing that I like to do. My dad did a fair bit of that, and I would get to go with them sometimes, the older boys, right? You know, and, they were hip boots, and, you know, I couldn't fit into hip boots really. So then I was just wearing extra Tufts, and I'd find my way to go over the top of those and whatnot. Actually, I didn't even have extra Tufts. I remember some of my first boots were these goofy-looking green things that had some shoelaces on them. They were like the younger kids couldn't fit in extra Tufts yet, you know, so it's kind of funny. But then, you know, for like hunting and stuff like that, I remember going and getting like incredibly cold. We got into the snow and the slush one time. I was about third grade, and then by the time we came down, and of course I got wet, and we have a saying in our family that cotton kills, you know, and they had these cotton long johns for kids back then, this waffle print, texture, right? And it would just suck that water in and just zap you. And I just remember a friend of mine, in fact, Greg Carlake, I remember we were talking about, you know, I like to quiz people, and I talked to him about his, you know, his EMT paramedic side of his job, you know, when we were dealing with wrestling injuries and things. And he talked about young kids, like, you know, younger than the wrestlers we were working with, but that they compensate really well until they don't, and then they crash. And it kind of made me always think back to that. Like, I was doing great, doing great, doing great. And then pretty soon my body was just kind of done. And my dad was like, literally like prodding me, let's go and dragging me a little bit. And at that age, you just want to shut down and let dad carry you. But when you're up on top of a mountain, it's not a thing. So I think that the base layers have improved dramatically. You know, not only, I remember getting to like middle school and I could finally start fitting into wool gear. And unfortunately, my mom's dad, my grandfather that I just loved to death, he passed away when I was in the seventh grade. And so I was about, he was a smaller guy and I was about his size. So I inherited some of the wool long underwear and it was super warm and effective, but it was really itchy. And so, you know, now we have the merino wools and the different capelines and the products. They're just incredible. And then, so graduating from hip boots to neoprene waders, we thought were the greatest things ever, but they would always start to leak at the seams and you would sweat and then you'd be cold. And it was, they were, I'll never forget putting my first pair of Sims waders on and walking out there and just going, and feeling kind of weird because they crinkle down on your legs a little bit. But then when you get back out, just that relief of like that compression relaxes and you just feel so loose and warm and good and even and never look back. Gore-Tex is phenomenal.
I remember growing up, it was extra tough boots or some sort of boot, but I'd always flood the boots. And then we had a pair of hip boots and I'd flood those. So it just got to the point where because I knew I was going to be wet, I might as well have better traction. So I just wore sneakers.
The traction's huge. Yeah. We used to use, when I was fishing, in fact, one of my jobs would be to, you know, finish up the down in the fish hold and get the last few fish. So you jump down there with hip boots and those things were dangerous. They were just terrible traction. And, you know, these, you know, the felt soles were pretty phenomenal, but even now these rubber soles that you have are just, they're awesome.
Yeah. And really then the rain gear is so nice too, because it can really make or break a trip. As soon as you start to get wet, even during the summer, like if you're just out there and you're sitting there, you're jigging or you're mooching, like you're not moving a whole lot and it's just wears on you.
Yeah, it is. And it's, so I'm pretty like psychotic about it, you know, that cotton kills thing, you know, I'd beat that into my kids' heads. And then, you know, because of the business, I have an angle to get some different pro deals and get some gear and things like that. And so I would always try to outfit the kids pretty well, but it was something you just pound into them. And now I'm still that way. I've got, you know, backup gear in dry bags in my pack, you know, just to make sure that I'm okay when I go steelhead fishing and whatnot. I've always bring a backup pair of waders and leave them on the boat. You know, I've got, just multiple layers, you know, it's just, it's just so important to stay warm. And, you know, I'll stuff a puff in my pack in a dry bag. And then if it's pretty cold, I'll have a down one in there also. And just always have that layer you can go to warm up. And then, and likewise, take them off, because we know the temperature swings are pretty incredible. Yeah. So, yeah, I would say the gear with that is amazing from a fishing standpoint. Obviously, you touch on the graphite rods. On the saltwater side, it's kind of funny. I'm fairly old school. I use a lot of stuff that we've, you know, kind of adopted from commercial fishermen and from friends. And so I'm still using a lot of flasher hoochie rigs and, you know, a lot of spoons and some different herring rigs also. But, you know, on the jigs, I mean, that's, you can do whatever you want. They have all kinds of goofy looking stuff. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is if you're in a good area, the fish are just going to be angry and get it. But, The boat side of things, like my 28 Bayliner, those were originally put out with like a 350 Chevy inboard engines, and they did about 18 knots and just chugged fuel, and they never really got up all the way on step, and the flywheel is down on the bilge, and it would kick salt water under the starter, and you know, so eventually duoprops came out, which gave a little more torque, and would get those boats doing a little better, and so I had a fuel-injected 454 with a duoprop in the boat, after I was upside down on it, right? That's kind of what I started my charter business with. And it did pretty well, but I got about 0.8 gallons to an hour or to a mile, at best. And I was doing about 22 knots. And then later when that thing started having problems, I switched to a Yamaha 350, put a bracket on it, and I cut my weight in half, went from about 1600 pounds down to 800 pounds. Mm-hmm. And increased my horsepower, and my fuel economy jumped up to like 1.4. So then when I built my new boat a few years later, I went to a 30 34-foot by 12-foot platform. So my platform got so much bigger. And I went to twin 300 Yamahas, and I still get 1.1 to 1.2 miles of the gallon, and I'm doing 27 knots. You know, it's like...
When you say built, this was a custom?
Yeah. Yep. Designed it on paper with, you know, just took a bunch of measurements from my friend's boats, kind of morphed about three boats together, and then contacted the builder, and then he set it up with a marine architect engineer, and they designed it. And
is
then,
that the one you have now, or have you used it?
Yeah. Yep.
That's a walk-around.
Yeah.
It's, well, it's the ones on Prince of Wales, you get like the cookie cutter. I mean, they're really, really nice boats, but those North Rivers are ubiquitous over there. Not a whole lot of walkarounds. There are some, I think Shelter Cove has gone to some walkarounds. Yeah. And it's interesting to see, because during the summers I'd fish over there, and I'd never fished over here until I moved here. And just to see the difference in, you know, we did mostly mooching over there, and then, you know, just the different styles, different areas, and to see, I mean, it all works, but
yeah, for sure. They're in a little different business model. Just one wrap up, I would just say where I was going to kind of finish up on the outboard scene. I mean, I remember seeing the first Merc, like 150 Black Max, and you just, they didn't make outboards big enough for that size of platform. And now, I mean, you're getting 425s and 600s or whatever there's out there. Pretty incredible. So that would be the technology on that end. Craig, Prince of Wales is a little different. They do a lot of 2 and 4 pack boats, you know, which is a nice little niche to be in. You know, if you can, they're doing single outboards typically on, you know, smaller North Rivers, which, you know, we sell a lot of North Rivers in this town, or, you know, Baco does, for example. They're a really nice hull and a great boat. They're running long ways like we are, but not always. They have a little more variety from a distance standpoint. I would kind of give credit to Sean Mitchell for being the first one. He had like a 32 by 12 platform. Alex Simmons runs it now, the same boat. And that was kind of a big paradigm shift. It was kind of a quasi. Sean had a commercial fishing history as well. And it was just kind of a mindset of building a little bigger platform to be able to do more with it. And, you know, but also use for your hunting and your fishing on your off time. And, you know, his was a full walk around without a V berth or anything. And I loved the boat, but I really wanted that bunk. So when I designed my boat, I put the bunk in it. And, you know, Daryl Welk had a Bayweld built early on like that, and Brad Salsa had a cold water built. Those were kind of the front edge of the boats. And then there were some guys that followed up with some Alamarines. You know, Sam Dalen and Ben Atwood and Shane Klinger had those boats, and they're a great charter boat. And I really like the design because they had that partial walk around with a step up with a bunk underneath. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't quite as big. So that was kind of the main where I robbed my idea from, is kind of made a bigger, better version of that. Mm-hmm. I don't know about better, but definitely bigger and better for me, I guess is would be the saying. So, yeah.
So when did the switch from fiberglass to aluminum really start to happen?
Oh boy. It seems like late 90s, mid 90s, you started seeing more and more aluminum. Aluminum's not perfect. I mean, fiberglass is more chemically inert. I mean, you can neglect a fiberglass boat and it's going to be fine. I mean, it's pretty incredible. I mean, but, you know, you drop a penny in an aluminum boat bilge and leave it sloshed around the salt water and, you know, I mean, there's any kind of dissimilar metals, right? You could have some big problems. And aluminum's cold and it sweats, or it can get too hot. Fiberglass is more heat resistant and sound deadening. But it's heavier and it, you know, is typically more expensive. It's petroleum based, so it was more expensive and not customizable, right? Mm-hmm. Those molds are what they are, and that's what you're going to get. The beautiful thing about the aluminum boats, like, I drew it all out on paper I robbed the interior layout of my buddy Sean's boat, and, you know, robbed the walk around width from Brad's cold water boat and Sean's boat. And then I kind of took the design from the Allen Marine boats, and you can give them that and they can do that on a CAD and then have those files cut and start assembling that boat. And then you pick everything. So I love the customization, and I wouldn't go back. I mean, I love aluminum. It's not perfect, but I do love it. You know, it's more abrasion resistant. So it took off. Yeah. I'd say the 2000s all the way through. And we're one of those areas that, you know, just has a ton of aluminum boats. You're not going to see them in Florida cause you burn your feet. Right.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Over here, there's a ton of, the Hughes Craft and, Raiders. And that's kind of with a lot more protected water over here. Actually, there's a lot over there too.
Yeah.
But it's just nice to have those. There's a lot of little coves to get around. And we had that 21-foot North River, which was nice. It was the Ragtop. And it had been, it was like 10, 15 years old or something like that. So it was starting to kind of degrade a little bit. But sold that to get rid of, or to free up some money for the house. And miss it.
Yeah.
But also it's nice to have the skiff. You can do a lot of stuff in the skiff. And, you know, so it's, you always have the trade-offs. There are some of my buddies who have nicer Hughes crafts. Like, man, I kind of miss the skiff. And just, it's super easy to just splash and you're gone. And you go right up to shore. It's super easy. Don't have to worry about it. The waves, of course, and the weather, you have to watch a lot more. But, you know, there's pros and cons to everything. There's no perfect boat.
Well, that's it. I think you've heard me say it a bunch of times. So the first guys that coined that for me were Jim and Charlie Freeman. You know, growing up being around the outboard shop as a kid, and my dad always had multiple boats. I mean, we always kind of had a boat problem, right? We'd have a speedboat and he had a 40 footer, and you know, just you kind of need, then I'd borrow my uncle's boat for different projects, right? And so the saying is, there's no perfect boat. I mean, it's just for what you want. And you hit it on the head. I mean, Ketchikan's such a cool boating place. I mean, honestly, it's just world-class boating, because there's nearby stuff and protected waters that you can still do a great job, you know, fishing. The rockfish and the halibut have been kind of picked over close to town, but the, you know, the salmon fishing can be incredible in close. And, you know, there's camping and there's water skiing and there's beachcombing and hunting adventures. There's so much. And then if you go out to that next range, you're more exposed. And so you probably want a little bigger boat for that, you know, and, you know, we went through all kinds of different boats. We had an old wooden boat that was only did 14 knots, you know, it was 40 footer, and it was, you know, but when you got there, you could, we'd do these around the island trips, and as a kid, and I learned so much, you know, and we would tow a skiff, and so you'd run around in the skiff when you're a kid, and just the most incredible trips in the summer. So much fun. And, you know, and also taught me a lot. And so I just think there's a lot of different types of boats out there, and you get it set. And some guys make a business decision with their charter boats to where they're just, you know, they're going for, you know, just specific, just bare bones for charter. In my case, I wanted to add more to it for my fun, you know, my hunting and fishing adventures and stuff. So, yeah.
So you added the rental, and you have a rental, and how many boats do you have with the rental? Or rentals?
So I've kind of, you know, I could expand, but I've just decided to just stay at three. I've got, you know, I could probably, you know, so we have three rental boats, and then we have a little family boat for kicking around, little Hughes Craft 18 footer. The kids water ski with it, and they take it deer hunting and different things. And then I have my charter boat. You know, the rentals, I kind of just watched out at Knutson Cove and all that. I never thought I would have got into that. And once I did get into it, I wish I hadn't. It took me about 4 or 5 years where I was like, I was upside down. Because, again, you have that initial investment. And then, you know, stuff kind of gets beat on. And I wasn't charging enough. That was a lesson I learned early on. And so you're looking at, like, if I sold everything, I'd still owe money, right? Mm-hmm. And so I kind of got stuck in that, just kind of funny. And then over time, I upgraded the boats, and we have like 80 to 90% return clientele, and it's gotten a lot better. But and we started charging more and whatnot over time. So we learned a lot of lessons there. But yeah, so three rental boats. It started, I think, in 05 or 06. I just kind of looked around and saw what other things we're doing. And we had an opportunity on some real estate, and I just kind of made the plunge. It was pretty crazy, honestly. So my summer chartering was kind of subsidizing it for the first few years, for sure. So I was kind of spinning my wheels, but then once, you know, you get places. I just was super aggressive about paying my debt down. And fortunately, I had a day job. I had a teaching job where, you know, that was a full-time income, and that would handle our household and living expenses. And everything from the business initially just kind of went back into paying debt off. And, and so just kind of grew to what it is. But, yeah, like you said in the opening, I would have never guessed I'd be here. You know, I just wouldn't. Yeah, it's different. So, and I love it. And I'm super thankful for both the self-guided stuff and the guiding right now. You know, I'm enjoying retirement a lot from teaching, but it's a weird adjustment. And if I didn't have any responsibilities, today I was in painting on one of my boats in the shop, you know, if I didn't have that kind of stuff, I'd probably be going a little crazy. I'm not really wired to not do things. Mm-hmm. I can't just sit and watch TV. There's no way. Yeah. So
people who come up here to fish during the summers, it's the best fishing that they've ever done in their lives. But people who've lived here can kind of compare what it was to what it is. So, mm-hmm. What have you noticed, as far as, you know, when I first got here, there was still a King Salmon Derby at the end of the school year. And those two weekends were huge.
Yeah.
And then it got moved to a Silver Salmon Derby. And so I was kind of here for that tail end of that. What have you noticed about, again, it's still world-class fishing. You can still have a great time. If you haven't fished anywhere else, then of course it's going to be the best you've ever done. But what have you noticed?
Well, I guess I've noticed some things I just want to qualify it with. I mean, it's, you know, the fishing game guys have harder data typically, right? And they're a little more aware. But I guess what I've noticed is, you know, the pinks are real dependent on weather. And they're natural. We're not hatchery enhancing any pink salmon. And so they kind of go up and down. And if you have these really dry summers, you know, it can really beat things down. And I used to always have people, you know, from Washington say, you know, do you guys have even year pinks or odd year pinks? What do you got? Because they had almost wiped out one of their runs. I'm not sure the status of it now, to be honest with you. And I used to be like, no, of course, tons of pride. We got both. Yeah. And then we had a tough summer in my guiding, and that summer was incredible fishing, by the way, like tons of fish. I was doing cruise ship charters when I first started out at Knutson Cove. So, you know, that was my bread and butter, pink salmon, right? I mean, kings and chums and cohos also, but, you know, it really kept you busy, especially with the young kids with the pinks. And then the weather hit that hot summer. I don't think it hardly rained the whole summer. And then that 2 years later, that cycle was way down. And so I've seen, you know, that was my first taste of that. And I've seen that up and down, and obviously with seining as well. Cohos, you know, a lot of my longtime commercials, fishing buddies, you know, that generation ahead. I remember talking to Gary Haynes and Russell and these guys, and they were like, you know, the cohos tend to run with the pinks. On a big pink year, you're going to have big coho years. But it's not always true, and I think, you know, it's mostly true for sure. But I've seen those silvers kind of, they're so aggressive, and they can get really beat down. And then the king salmon also have fluctuated. Like, my ocean fishing for king salmon has been phenomenal every year. I mean, because there's a lot of Canadian Washington fish going by, and we're getting the front edge of those, you know, the ones that are coming locally. But, you know, their escapement has not been good, and they had to curtail that. And it's pretty sad to lose the Derby, honestly.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with a bigger fish that's more sensitive to different things. I think everybody, all the old timers, worry about herring volumes. And, you know, we used to have herring spawns down in the Cachakes area and whatnot. You know, it isn't. And Cleveland Peninsula had a big herring fishery, and they quit fishing that. And a lot of the herring really hasn't come back to the numbers that old timers talk about. You know, my dad would talk about playing down on the docks at City Float and stuff, and their unsupervised time. There's some pretty funny stories, you know, with that. But there would be herring spawn in the channel, and there would be sea lions and birds, and, you know, the channel would be alive back in the day. So I hear those stories, and, you know, we don't have that. You know, Bell Island used to be a thing when I was a kid, and you know, people would hammer and fish at that Bell Island cut, which probably had an impact on the king salmon. And then there's a lot of controversy with king salmon hatcheries and what, you know, kind of pressure that kind of puts on the wild fish. And I just have read some of that stuff, but I'm not, you know, in the know to know, you know, exactly if that's true or what's going on. I mean, a biologist would be a better source for that. But yeah, so I guess king salmon, cohos down, chums are, you know, I watched them, you know, hammer away at those Chomley, wild chums in Chomley that they got overfished. And so there were some issues with that, but mostly I think our issues are with the predatory fish, the kings and this, you know, cohos. But those are so hatchery enhanced that it, you know, we still have great fish in here, right?
Yeah.
Mountain Point you know, there's tons of hatchery fish, right? And it's still good. And same with the cohos. I mean, a lot of the fish we're catching are definitely hatchery fish. So anyway.
Yeah, we've had the benefit of looking at what didn't work in California, what didn't work in Oregon, what didn't work in Seattle. So we have a vast amount of information at our disposal. Right. And even here, like the bad management of the past, we can learn from those bad practices and see what we want to do going forward. So it does inspire a little bit more trust at times to think, okay, these, we have volumes and volumes of information and we're hopefully making the best decisions.
Yeah. I feel like the management's mostly good. I mean, they can't be perfect. And the budget cuts scare me when they start having less, you know, people working to, you know, manage your fisheries that, you know, or less money to do stream surveys, et cetera. But overall, I think they do good, but you're exactly right. And we have a small population and we haven't dammed up all of our rivers. And there's a number of things we have going for us. And I would also say that those fish are somewhat weather dependent as well. I mean, I've seen those cohos cycle down. We had, it's probably 6 years ago, I guess. Yeah, 6 to 8 years ago, we had some real down years. I remember one summer in particular, we had that blob that showed up with the, you know, plankton bloom and you know, fishing, it used to be, I typically kind of get a, you know, 24 cohos in an hour and a half, 2 hours, sometimes, you know, 35, 40 minutes if it's real hot, but, you know, never more than a couple hours, you know, to get that limit and get your limit of halibut and dink around a little bit and head back, you know, and we had all these short days and you're like, God, I'd much rather do full days. I mean, the fishing's exciting. It's a long run out there, but, you know, I limit in 3 hours, you know, and it's like, it's awesome. And they still pay you for a full day and, you know, you got a long run back, but you're home by 2 o'clock or sometimes one or noon or something crazy like that. And then we got into these years where it just started beating down and you'd get close to limits or you'd get, you know, 7 or 8 cohos. And then I remember one day is the first week of August when the summer run cohos should be phenomenal in the ocean fishing that we do. And I went to Mary Island, no fish. I mean, I'll just summarize this. I went to Mary Island, and then I went over to Slate Island, and then down to Foggy Bay and Tree Point, over to Club Rocks, and back to East Island. And that day I caught 2 cohos, and I'm pretty good at it, right? I know how to get these fish, right? And so 2 cohos, and we got our halibut and picked up a rockfish or two, but I mean, it's salmon fishing should be lights out, right? So the next day I'm pretty frustrated and I go down and I hit Dollhead, Percy Point, and then I go to the Pinnacle, West Rock, across to, went all the way out to Nunez, in fact, and then doubled back, fished the Cape proper, and then Stone Rocks, 2 more fish.
Wow.
And I was just so crushed. I was just like, the world's coming to an end, you know, and you see these sanders running around just searching for fish. And it just felt like, wow, this is catastrophic. It's within my lifetime. And I think some of it was weather dependent. There might have been other issues that some people that know more than me could tell you. But then COVID happened and things started trending up, you know, just like just before that, we were starting to get some things going on. I noticed better snowpack in the summer, some things like that, which I'm a little worried about this winter, by the way. But things just built up. And the last 2 or 3 seasons, it's been back to these, you know, like, I mean, it's kind of awkward sometimes because you had these people when we were struggling and fishing all day. And now they're like, yeah, we're limited in 40 minutes, 30 minutes, you know, 36 cohos in under an hour. I mean, it's been some really good fishing. And you're like, yeah, all right, time to go home. And they're like, well, isn't there something else we can do? We're like, yeah, don't be pigs. We've limited on everything. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what else to tell you.
Already seen the whales, already seen.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, so it's super exciting. The fishing's phenomenal, but it's kind of like the salmon fishing has been back to what I'd call normal. Mm-hmm. Rockfish and halibut are still pretty, you know, a little more difficult. You know, it's been more of a downward trend with those guys, but the salmon have rebounded, and I'm hoping that we have another great salmon season this summer. Mm-hmm. But the last 3 or 4 salmon seasons have been lights out, but it hasn't been widespread. It's in certain areas. Last year was widespread, very widespread, in fact. But and we've got a lot of fall fish around as well. The fall was phenomenal too. So anyway, but
yeah, how you fish it can make a big difference too. Like I remember a couple times fishing out of Knutson Cove where Abby and I are getting silvers pretty quick. and other people around are just kind of struggling. You know,
yeah.
Depth, color, all those things can matter. Some days it doesn't. It doesn't. Right. I mean, you could throw down a it doesn't even matter, and you're going to catch the fish. But other times, just that knowledge of how to fish things correctly goes a long way in being super efficient with getting your fish.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. For me, I have some pretty basic concepts and some you know, like I kind of approach it from a science, you know, my science training a little bit, like try to limit the variables that I change. I didn't really dabble in too many flasher colors in the beginning. I kind of stuck to one flasher because I didn't want to change variables, and then a handful of rigs that you develop confidence in. And then, you know, you want to avoid pulling, you know, like if the fishing's slow, pulling out the ones that you always catch fish on and putting those on the bench and then having a whole new host of stuff down there. Because when that bite turns back on, now you got B squad gear or experimental gear, right? It may not work. You know, there's just different people have different things, and I just say stick with what works. And sometimes, you know, like you say, you come in and you got your routine, stick with that and make note of when that is and what the tides are doing and what the run strength is like and, you know, time of day, you know, you just kind of start putting that whole picture together for yourself. But then there's also the exciting, like, it's just like something that's just they are tuned into right now. Mm-hmm. Like I've had times early in my career, especially, and you learn like, oh, I'm getting my butt just kicked by these Livingstons, you know, trolling cut plugs behind the boat, you know, on flat lining mm-hmm. with a banana lead and a cut plug, you know, and they're just, I'm always worried about running over their gear, getting that caught in my boat, right? When I used to fish out there and, you know, but then you're like, huh, well, they're doing really well with that, I guess, you know. So I started goofing around with clipping my downrigger in, but running like 60, 70 feet of line behind my downrigger and shallowing up, and you start picking up fish. Or maybe you need to start running a cut plug and dodger because they're just a lot more hungry for that, mm-hmm. right? So it's just kind of fun. You can always learn things from, well, it's just really fun, actually, but you can learn things from people that know next to nothing about fishing. You can pick up some little things from them. And then, you know, if you're lucky, you can get around some people that really know stuff and, mm-hmm. and rob from them a little bit. And it's a lot of different areas to attack and, you know, try some different stuff, but yeah, it's fun.
So coming back over an hour at this point. I know you get 85-90% of your clients are rebooked, but if someone was looking to come up here and fish with you, how would they find you? How would they follow you? Get in contact.
So I've got a website, explorealaskacharters.com. So they could get a hold of me that way. The Cedars Lodge, I do a ton of work with them. So they could contact Sid down at the Cedars and she sets stuff up. You know, as far as, you know, like self-guided, I'm currently 100% booked. I've got had a couple cancellations for guided. So I do have a few openings, not too many, but you know, I'm always, you know, happy to kind of connect people too. I mean, if I don't have room or space for what they're looking for, you know, I've got a short list that I feel pretty good about recommending. And then beyond that, I don't want to get into it too much. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. So yeah, it just kind of depends if they're looking for a full day, half day or whatever. But yeah. So anyway, we have a lot of really good guides in this town, a lot of locals. You know, not that, you know, we have some guys from Lower 48, obviously, they grew up down there that are outstanding also. I didn't really mean it like that. But there's a lot of guys that spend a lot of time here and have done well with it. And, you know, and then there's the guys that are, you know, they're a tier back, you know, but they're still putting on a good trip. They're doing different things. So mm-hmm. there's just a big variety out there of experiences. And, you know, and there's other people in the self-guided fishing game. You know, obviously, people head out to Clover Pass and rent boats and, you know, all the different marinas and stuff. So, yeah, it's pretty neat opportunity, really, for people around here. It's just pretty incredible boating. But if I wasn't guiding, I kind of get beat down on the trolling personally. You know, I mean, I love it, especially king season, whatnot. I love the guiding part of it. But, you know, I kind of, when I daydream about some days off, I daydream about still going out on the boat, but going camping and hiking into places fishing and flying in and just incredible stuff. So yeah,
cool. So, thanks, man, appreciate you coming on here.
All right, you bet. Hopefully this worked for you. So, never done one of these, so all right. Hey, thank you.
Thanks.
Okay.